Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word.
I'm joined today on the G word podcast by Holly Ellis, who's a clinical scientist in genetics and works in the NHS at the Northwest Genomics Laboratory Hub, which we're going to learn all about. Holly, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me.
And Holly, I should also mention that you have a stage name, which is the Scouse Scientist, which we're going to learn more about. But I'll call you Holly for the chat, if that's okay. Holly, how did you get into this whole area of medicine, genetics, genomics? Tell us a bit about how that happened.
Growing up, I guess science wasn't really something that I ever thought I'd get into, to be honest, just because it was nothing that I thought was sort of for me. Do you know what I mean? I didn't think it was for people from my type of background and things like that. But then at school, I was getting sort of really good grades across the board in sciences and maths. And some of my teachers encouraged me to go down that path. And I first became interested in genetics, really, when at school our science building was actually called the Rosalind Franklin Building, who I'm sure everyone knows who that is. And one day we were told the story of who Rosalind Franklin was and how she played a huge part in discovering the structure of DNA, but often didn't get the credit that she deserved because all the credit went to Watson and Crick. And that got me thinking. And I guess that's what really sparked my interest in genetics in the first place. And then I went off to uni. I did biological sciences at Oxford. And as part of that covered sort of everything. But it was always the genetics part that I was just really, really interested in. I just found it so interesting. I sort of got it. It just clicked with me. It was just one of those things I didn't really need to work too hard to understand. And I just found it fascinating how it's a field that's constantly changing. And even from me doing my GCSEs and A-levels, so much has changed already. So it's a field where you're just sort of constantly learning, I guess. So it was definitely something that I wanted to be involved in. But after uni, I didn't really know how to get involved in it. So I started volunteering in the genetics lab in Liverpool in the NHS. And from there, I sort of built up my experience and I got a Band 3 job. And then I joined the NHS Scientist Training Programme. And now I'm back in the same lab where I started, but as a clinical scientist.
Fantastic. And what were you doing when you initially volunteered? Or how did that start? And then how did that grow into the training programme and now, you know, being a part of the hub yourself?
So when I obviously decided I wanted to get into genetics, I quickly realised I had very limited experience in genetics. So I thought I'd better try and, you know, get into a lab and get some experience. So I just sort of emailed lots of different people, got lots of rejections, like we don't want volunteers, but eventually somebody did want to volunteer. So I was taking on in the lab, and I was just doing some basic tasks like, you know, booking samples into the system. So a sample that arrived in the lab, just booking it into the system, giving it a unique lab number, and just being generally helpful, I think, or trying to be to the lab staff. But although that was sort of, you know, I was only doing basic tasks, I really learned a lot about how the day-to-day running of the lab worked. And from there, I was offered a Band 3 post. And then the sort of scientist training program was a separate thing from that. So I applied for that sort of as an external candidate, but definitely my volunteering and previous experience in the lab helped me to get onto that. So what I say to everyone who follows me is just, you know, create your own opportunities. There wasn't any job advert for a volunteer in that lab at that time, but I just think, you know, sometimes you've just got to create your own opportunities and make the most of it as well.
And so just to be clear, at the point that you volunteered in the lab, you already had your degree from Oxford?
Yeah, that's correct.
Wow, okay. So that says to me maybe we need to be doing something as an ecosystem to make it easier for incredibly qualified people to find us or to find the roles, right?
I think the problem or one of the difficulties I found was that people sort of value experience in the lab over, you know, qualifications, which is fair enough. You know, I couldn't have gone straight into a clinical scientist role from just doing my degree, because you do need to sort of go and learn the basics before you can go on to do the other stuff. So it was difficult, but actually it probably did help me a lot to have that experience under my belt before I became a clinical scientist.
Well, that's fascinating. So you were blessed not only, you're a sort of self-described science nerd when you were a kid, but you were blessed not only with the kind of the science nerd brain, but also with the kind of, I guess, like energy or zest to kind of go after it and make your own opportunities, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about your role today in the lab. What do you do when you get up in the morning?
So as a clinical scientist, I'm actually based on the oncology team in the lab at the minute. So the service that I'm sort of responsible for is the DPYD service. So this is quite a hot topic at the minute because it's obviously a new pharmacogenomic test. And just to provide a little bit of background, this test is for patients who are waiting for to be treated with chemotherapy containing fluoropyrimidines. So we test them for four variants in the DPYD gene, and based on their results, we don't identify a variant, they get given the full dose of chemo. If we identify one or two variants, then they may need a reduced dose of the chemo, or they might need an alternative therapy because basically they're prone to toxicity when given this type of chemo. So that's sort of the service I'm responsible for. So the day-to-day running of that service involves receiving the samples into the lab. The GTs, the genetic technologists, do all sort of the lab work, but I do more of the analysis, the checking the data, writing the reports, interpreting the results. Sometimes dealing with clinicians, you know, it is a fast turnaround time test with 5 days. So a lot of the time we get clinicians sort of calling us up saying, this patient needs the chemo today. Can we, you know, speed up a bit? And in some cases we can. In other cases, you know, the test does take a set amount of time and there's nothing we can do to speed that up. So it's the day-to-day running of that service, really. And obviously there's a lot of other things I do as well, with, you know, education and training and things like, we have a duty scientist, which we do one day a week, sort of dealing with queries and deciding what tests each sample should go for patients who've got hematological malignancies. So it's quite busy, but it's really good.
Never a dull moment.
No, definitely not.
If I just put myself in the shoes of a patient who's potentially up for chemo, they would give a blood sample, is that right? And then would you guys get the blood? And what happens with kind of all the machines? What do the genetic technologists do?
Yeah, that's right. So a patient will be told that they're getting this type of chemo. So before they get that, they need this test. So yeah, they'll just give a blood sample. The bloods will arrive in the lab. Then the genetic technologists will book it into the system. The first stage is DNA extraction. So from that blood sample, we end up with a small bit of DNA. I have done a video on DNA extraction, which I know you're going to talk about later. So I won't go into all the details, but yeah, that's all done on sort of a big machine. Blood goes in, DNA comes out. It's not quite as simple as that, but you get the idea. And then it's a PCR test that we do. So polymerase chain reaction, where we amplify up, make lots of copies of the DPYD gene. We're basically just looking for these four known variants that are known to cause toxicity to 5-FU, which is the type of chemo. And then basically we end up with sort of electropherogram type graphs, which show us the wild type and the mutant alleles, and then it's our job to interpret the data from there.
I would hugely recommend to anyone listening to watch the videos that that you've done. There was one on DNA extraction, one on the work with the DPYD gene, and they're hugely informative. It's one of those things where actually seeing the machines and seeing the technicians in the lab going through the process really brings it to life. I remember when I was a kid, one of the things I loved watching on Sesame Street was when they would do something like go to a crayon factory or whatever, and you see all of the big machines and all of the stuff coming out and then turning into crayons. You're like, wow, God, that's how crayons are made. So they're really informative in that kind of way. They're great. And so on top of running this pretty high pressure, fast turnaround, you know, life or death service in the NHS, you've also found time over the last couple of years to do more than that and become a bit of an educator and ambassador in this field. Tell us a bit about the inspiration for the Scouse Scientist.
Yeah, so basically throughout my life, I get loads of people saying to me, oh, you went to Oxford, you're a scientist. Oh, you don't look like you went to Oxford. You don't sound like you're a scientist. You know, these type of things, which, you know, you could get offended by, but I just, you know, I just sort of laugh it off, and I'm not offended by it because I feel like the problem isn't with people. The problem is that we all have this stereotypical image of what a scientist is.
The sort of Einstein kind of crazy hair and glasses and sort of old man kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we all picture when we picture a scientist. But I actually feel that, you know, if that's what everyone sort of thinks a scientist is, and, you know, that's what they look like, then how can young women aspire to become scientists? So I'm a great believer of, if you can see it, then you can be it. So I wanted to really provide a role model for young women in STEM, because I feel like there's not a lot of, you know, representation from sort of working class young women in science. So I wanted to young people to sort of look at me and see, you know, I'm from a sort of working class background. I've got a strong Scouse accent, which, you know, I'm not prepared to change, and I don't think I should. And I want them to sort of look at me and think, well, if she's a scientist, then I can be it too. Because I feel that young people can definitely relate to me. And I guess it's about, as well as that part of it, it's really educating people about genomic testing in the NHS. Like, as you know, Chris, genomics is becoming more and more integrated into lots and lots of different services in the NHS. And I think it's going to have a huge impact on, you know, healthcare in the future. So I think we really need to reach out to people who perhaps wouldn't have engaged with science previously. And it's just about reaching that really broader audience and telling them about genomics, so that they, you know, if they need to get a test in the future, they're confident in doing that. They're not worried, and they understand exactly what it is that we're doing.
Yeah, it's so important, and it's hugely inspiring, and it's great to see the videos. I was talking to someone recently who was thinking about coming to Genomics England, and you mentioned about, you know, young women from a working class background, and, you know, that you've got a Scouse accent and so on. I think another angle which I hadn't really thought about before this conversation recently was that she had said that when she was younger in her career, she's a data scientist, someone had said to her, oh, you're too glamorous to be a data scientist. It's like, what? So hold on. So I'm supposed to be like a man, I'm supposed to have like a sort of whatever Southeast accent, And if I'm a woman, then I'm supposed to be dowdy as well. I can't win, you know. it's crazy.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a huge problem, and I get the same, you know. And that's why sort of on my social media channels, I do put a lot of stuff on about being a scientist and what we do in the lab, but then I do try and put some pictures on where, you know, I am a bit glammed up and I'm having a bit of a night out and things like that, so that young people can see, you know, you can be both. You don't need to choose. And just because you're a scientist doesn't mean you can't have a life outside of that as well. So that's why I do try and put little snippets of, I guess, my own sort of normal life as well, so that people can see it's not all just, you know, I'm not just obsessed with science constantly throughout my life.
Exactly, that scientists are human too, sort of shock horror.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've mentioned this point, which I think is so important, about genetics and genomics becoming more and more a part of the mainstream of the NHS, and therefore more and more people either having genetic tests or their family being affected by that in some way. As this kind of science and these kind of approaches come more and more into the mainstream, what are some of the issues that you think people, regular people, patients, just need to understand or start getting their heads around or sort of think through?
Well, I think that people are scared sometimes we don't see patients face to face, but, you know, if you said, I'm going to get some DNA from you, people sort of worry, what are you going to do with that DNA? How is my data going to be stored? How is it going to be used against me? You know, those sorts of things. And it's really important for people to understand that in the NHS, we've extracted your DNA and we're testing you for, you know, these variants in DPYD. That is all we are going to test you for. We're not going to do anything else with your DNA. We're literally testing you for 4 variants in DPYD. You've either got them or you haven't, and that's it. That's all we're doing. And I guess it's about gaining patients' trust, really, in that what we are going to do with the DNA, and we're not going to test it for all these different things without their consent, basically. And it's just, I guess, them knowing what their rights are. And if they don't, sometimes we do store patients' DNA in our lab, but that's only used sort of for quality control purposes. And again, we'd never test that for anything that they've not consented for. So, and if they don't want their DNA stored in the lab, then that's fine. They can, there's always a box on the referral form where they can tick if they don't want us to store the DNA, and that's fine. And I guess it's just communicating that to patients, you know, we're only testing what they agree to, basically.
Yeah, so it's all based on choice, as you say. And it's interesting, we've done a bunch of focus groups on various topics at Genomics England and so on, and a lot of the concerns that come up beyond even, you know, what's it going to be used for in the lab or in the hospital, are things like, people say, well, what if the police get access to that? And, you know, if I'm framed for a crime that I didn't commit because my DNA is then at the crime scene, or what if that goes to an insurer and I can't get health insurance because I've got something I don't even know about, but that the health insurance company knows about. And as you say, we've got to communicate, we've got to build trust. And there's something important about how can we demonstrate that we're trustworthy, that we're worthy of that trust. And I realize this is a big question, but do you have any thoughts on what we as an ecosystem, kind of the NHS, Genomics England, the Department of Health, others, can be doing to kind of demonstrate that we're trustworthy?
Yeah, I guess it's just being open about what it is that we're doing. And again, communication is so, so important, and being transparent with what's going on. We're not sort of sneaking in genomic testing here and there. And, you know, it goes down to even the people who are, you know, the nurses, the midwives, the genetic counsellors, that we're all communicating the same message. And when patients are undergoing a genomic test, that they know that's what it is. Because, you know, often these patients, especially patients with cancer, they get blood tests all the time for different things, you know, biochemistry tests, hematology tests. But it's actually about pointing out, this is a genomic test where we are testing you know, germline DNA and distinguishing that from all the different other tests that they might be getting. I think that's really important.
Yeah, so it's that transparency, and also, I don't know, education can sometimes feel like a sort of patronizing way of thinking about it, but I guess just engaging with the patient and having that conversation, right?
Yeah.
One of your videos I really enjoyed was around genetic counseling and how we can explain this to people. As you know, these things become more and more common, and more people have genetic or genomic tests of one kind or another. Do we just need an army of genomic counselors, or how can we scale that? I mean, we saw some experiments in Canada around using AI chatbots to do genetic counseling. Some people have really strong views for that. Some people have really strong views against that. Like, what do you think is a way that we can help patients who are going through these processes to understand that and to be reassured kind of at the kind of national scale that we're talking about?
Yes, so I feel that, you know, genetic counselors play a huge, huge role. But as you say, as genomic testing is sort of ramped up, we can't refer every single patient to a genomic counselor unless we employ thousands and thousands of genetic counselors. So I think a huge, huge part of the sort of ramp up in genomic testing will be workforce development. So it's sort of, you know, educating within the NHS, educating our nurses, our clinicians, our midwives, our pharmacists, so that they can sort of do the educating themselves. Obviously, difficult scenarios or more complicated things and things where patients really need to consider whether they want the test or not will still have to go to the experts who are the counsellors. But sort of everyday genomic testing, I think we need to sort of look at the NHS as a whole and everyone who is dealing with patients. And it's not just a case of, right, this is a genetic test, the counsellors deal with this, but actually everyone who works in the NHS who's involved with genomics at any level should be educated and should have the confidence, hopefully, to explain the test for themselves and explain what the results mean themselves. So I think that's really a huge, huge thing that needs to happen over the next few years.
Absolutely. And you're someone who works in genomics and genetic tests applied to cancer. What do you think we can expect to see over the next 5, 10, 20 years in this space? Another big question, are we going to cure cancer? What's going to happen? What should we expect to see?
So I don't think it's a case of, yes, we are going to cure cancer, or no, we're not going to cure cancer. But I think it's a case of genomics is obviously paving the way for this more personalised or stratified medicine. So we're no longer, already in a lot of cancers now, we're using genomic information not only to predict a patient's response to a particular drug, as in the case of the field of pharmacogenomics, but also, you know, to give them a diagnosis maybe, or a prognosis. So there's certain genetic abnormalities that are diagnostic of, say, CML, so chronic myeloid leukemia. That's probably one of the most well-known examples, whereby a translocation between two chromosomes is sort of diagnostic of CML. And that obviously then means patients can have more targeted therapies rather than the generic chemo that will damage all cells, healthy and cancerous, as opposed to more targeted treatments, which based on the genomic information can target the cause of the cancer, sort of the root cause, rather than just sort of targeting non-specifically. So I think that's the way it's definitely going to go. You know, CML was one of the first where we were able to do that, with patients being able to go onto this imatinib drug. Then we've also got, you know, the PARP inhibitors for some breast cancers, and we're getting more and more of these targeted therapies. And I think that's definitely the way forward. And as we learn more about genomics, I'm sure we'll find more of these sort of molecular markers for cancer that will enable us to provide these targeted therapies as well, and for more targeted therapies to be developed. So I think that's definitely the way forward. And who knows, like you said, are we going to cure cancer? Well, hopefully that will certainly help us along the way for some of them, for sure.
A journey of 1,000 miles takes lots of steps, I guess.
Exactly.
So Holly, your story is hugely inspiring. What can we as Genomics England or the wider community be doing to try and break down barriers and get more young people interested in science and, I guess, particularly genomics? How do you think we can create, an army of future Hollies?
So I think we definitely need to create more opportunities for young people to get involved in genomics. You know, as I said, I luckily managed to get a voluntary job at the lab, but those opportunities are quite hard to come by, and they're not well advertised or anything like that. Or in my case, it wasn't really advertised at all. I just sort of wormed my way in. But I think we do need to create more opportunities for young people. I think we need to be careful about the types of people that we are, that the media are portraying as scientists in genomics. You know, we've seen loads of scientists in the media over the past few years with the COVID pandemic on our screens more regularly, people thinking about science more than ever. But what type of people are they putting sort of on that stage to everyone? You know, a lot of the time they have been the stereotypical white middle class male, in my opinion. There've been the odd few women which have been really good, but I think we need to increase our diversity of scientists that we are putting out there for people to see as well, because I think people, going back to the trust thing, they trust people who they can relate to. Do you know what I mean? And if they feel sort of detached from people or anything like that, then straight away that's going to put a barrier between the scientists and the public. So I think that's a really, really important thing, to just increase the diversity of the workforce and also the diversity of people that we are actually getting to communicate genomics as well. Because, you know, I'm out there saying I'm the Scouse scientist, but I'm not the Scouse scientist. There's thousands and thousands of Scouse scientists just like me, and all I'm doing is trying to represent that community, basically.
It's a really great point about I'm a Scouse scientist, not the Scouse scientist, right? The difference in the word is really meaningful. And so one of the things we're trying to do with this podcast series is get, as you put it, more and different voices out there. Are there either any topics or any people that you think we should be reaching out to bring onto the pod?
Oh, that's really interesting. I think... I know I've listened to a few of your most recent ones. I think getting people who are actually, you know, working in the labs, like you have me on, who's working in the GLH, maybe counsellors that are actually, they've got real patient stories. And I think people like listening to stuff, again, that they can relate to, or they think, oh, that could happen to me, that sort of thing. So, you know, getting patient stories out there is a really good way to engage with people, I think.
Brilliant. That's a really good point. And it's the human stories that we can all relate to, isn't it? That people like us. Super. Well, thank you so much for making the time to come onto the podcast today. Thank you for everything you're doing with bringing demystifying the world of the lab, the world of genomics. It's hugely powerful.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.